بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله وعلى آله وصحبه ومن والاه. ثم أما بعد، to proceed. So today, inshallah, we will try to finish the introductions, the introductions of القواعد الفقهية. And we call this coherence of Sharia. So we said that there are 10 different things or 10 different principles that we need to go over to introduce any subject. And we last time we were talking about istimdad, right? The sources of al-qa'ad al-faqiyya. Where do we derive al-qa'ad al-faqiyya from? Today, inshallah, we will try as much as we can to cover the following, which may be a lot, but inshallah, we'll try to cover as much as we can. So we will cover the emergence and development. الظهور والتطور. ظهور القاعدة الفقهية وتطورها. We will, inshallah, try to cover the benefits and merits and authority, the authority or proof value, and the ruling of learning القاعدة الفقهية. So we're covering about 5 of the 10 principles today, inshallah, if we can. So let us first start with the emergence of al-qa'ad al-faqiyya. How did al-qa'ad al-faqiyya emerge? And I have to caution you that when we talk about emergence of al-qa'ad al-faqiyya, that does not necessarily mean that these maxims were not in the minds of the Sahaba and the Tabi'een or Tabi'a Tabi'een. They were not in the minds of the great mujtahids until we say that they emerged in the 4th century. No, we're talking about the science as a science. We're talking about it being a discipline and people writing, you know, in that discipline and authoring books in that discipline. So as we said in Usul al-Fiqh, the fact that Imam Shafi'i rahimahullah was the first one to author on Usul al-Fiqh, so we consider him to be the wada or the founder of the science of usul al-fiqh. That does not mean that there was no usul al-fiqh before him, and that the sahaba and the tabi'in did not have any usul or principles of jurisprudence in their mind. So this also applies to al-qawa'd al-fiqhiyya. However, the difference between al-qawa'd al-fiqhiyya and usul al-fiqh is that, as we said before many times, which one comes first, qawa'id al-fiqhiyya or usul al-fiqh? Usul al-fiqh. Usul al-fiqh, you know, naturally, technically, precedes fiqh, because this is how you make fiqh. This is how you produce fiqh, how you deduce rulings from the text of revelation by usul al-fiqh. And then, as we said before, now that you have the entire body of fiqh and you do your inductive survey of the entire body of fiqh, and you come up with certain patterns, and you call them maxims, qawaad. You call those patterns that you have come up with through your inductive survey of fiqh, qawaad. Therefore, it would be natural that al-qawaad al-fiqhiyya would come later, you know, and they would develop slower than usul al-fiqh and fiqh. Fiqh itself developed much faster than usul al-fiqh, right? Because usul al-fiqh, we're talking about authoring on usul al-fiqh, but fiqh itself, they needed it. They needed it all the time. So there was always fatawa, and there were always mufteen and fuqaha. During the time of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, it was basically copying the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. The Prophet did not say this is wajib, this is mustahab, this is this. He said, Sallu kama ra'aytumuni yusalli, pray as you see me praying. So the Sahaba prayed as they saw him praying. Khudhu anni manasika, take your right from me or your rituals from me. That's in Hajj. So they copied him. They copied him. But thereafter, they needed, you know, to figure out what is wajib, what is mustahab, and they needed to categorize things and organize things for those who came afterwards, who were not like the Sahaba, simply copying the Prophet ﷺ, doing everything as he did. Qawaid al-fiqhiyya would you will find in the notes. And those who are not getting the notes, you should try to get the notes. You should try to basically subscribe to the email list and get the notes and read them before you come in. So those of you who read the 004, you know, Coherence of Sharia 004 that I just placed in your folder, would know that Imam al-Mardawi, rahimahullah, gave us a little bit of brief summary of the development of al-Qawaid al-Fiqhiyya. What did he say? He, I'm not going to basically read Imam al-Mardawi's entire sort of history of Qawaid or, paragraph on the history of Qawaid, but I'm just going to stop at the main stops in what he talked about. So the first thing he mentioned was Abu Tahir al-Dabbas. Abu Tahir al-Dabbas. So this is a Hanafi imam who died. Nobody exactly knows what time he died. He was in Transoxania, like beyond the river. So this Hanafi, he was one of the great Hanafi imams, and he died around 340. No one exactly knows when he died, but since he and Al-Karkhi, another Hanafi imam, known Hanafi imam, were basically contemporaries, died around the same time. Karkhi died about 340, so we're giving him 340. That neighborhood. He died in that neighborhood. So he was in the end of the third, beginning of the fourth centuries. And they say that Abu Tahir al-Dabbas, he distilled the Hanafi fiqh into about 17 maxims. He distilled or referred the Hanafi fiqh back to or distilled it into about 17 maxims. And he used to basically repeat them to himself. He was probably still working on them. He didn't want to share them. He was very reluctant to share them. And people felt, like it depends on how people look at this. But yeah, anyway, he was reluctant to share with anyone. So he would repeat them. So another scholar by the name of Abu Sa'id al-Harawi came and tried to hide himself. After Aisha, he would close the door of the masjid and he would sit down and repeat them. He was blind, so he'd sit down and repeat them. So he hid somewhere, Abu Sa'id al-Harawi, and he kept on repeating them until Abu Sa'id al-Harawi coughed. And then he coughed after he mentioned somewhere around four of them. So he caught him and he basically stopped repeating them to himself completely ever since. So he himself did not write anything. Al-Imam al-Karkhi wrote some of the Qawa'id in his book on Usul al-Fiqh. He wrote some of the Qawa'id, and then came Abu Zayd al-Dabbus in the 5th century and wrote a book by the name of Ta'zis al-Nadhar, which included more qawaid. Having heard of this, Al-Qadi Hussein, this was a Shafi'i scholar who died about 462 after Hijrah. Having heard of this, he said, okay, I'll do it to the Shafi'i fiqh. And he distilled the Shafi'i fiqh into four qawaid. What are those four qawaid? Okay. Seclude the first one of the five, and that would be the four. So, al-yaqeen la yazul bishak, which is certainty is not overruled by doubt, al-darar yuzal, harm is to be removed, مشقة تجلب التيسير, hardship begets facility, and العادة محكمة, which means custom is authoritative. Custom authoritative. These are four قواعد that he came up with. الإمام الحرمين أبو المعالي said that it is questionable whether you could actually refer all of the fiqh back to those four قواعد. He said it would take, you know, تكلف and وسائط and تكلف, many intermediaries and like considerable effort to basically refer all the fiqh back to those four قواعد. But الحافظ العلائي, who is an 8th century scholar, 8th century scholar, 700s, died about 726 or something. He said that when I was in Cairo, I noted from some of the scholars that someone had added to these four, a fifth maxim, and that fifth maxim is al-umur bimaqasadiha, which is matters are judged by their intentions. This is how we got to the five major, most comprehensive legal maxims. It took hundreds of years. So we are fortunate to have them at our fingertips. But it took hundreds of years to develop in that sense. Does that mean they were not aware of these concepts? There is a difference between having a like the mental concept and putting it down in writing, in black and white, and authoring, and so on and so forth. So they were aware of the concept. الأمور بمقاصدها is not basically a novel concept. The Prophet said that أعمال بالنيات, deeds are but by their intentions. So when you say الأمور بمقاصدها, matters are judged by intentions, that's, you know, some people, even as I said before, use the hadith as the qaida, as the formula for the qaida itself. So this is basically a quick summary of, and certainly afterwards, books like Al-Ashbah wal-Nadha'ir by Imam Suyuti, Imam Ibn al-Najayim. Imam Suyuti is a Shafi'i scholar, died in 911, and Imam Ibn al-Najayim is a scholar who died in 970. So we're talking about 10th century now. And these are very developed books on al-qawa'id al-fiqhiyya, al-ashbah wal-nadha'ir. As we said before, they called them al-ashbah wal-nadha'ir to include some of the scenarios where there are some similarities, but at the end of the day, the rulings differ or diverge because there are some dissimilarities, And we called it Ashbah al-Nadha'ir, parallels and analogues. And we said the Nadha'ir are those scenarios where there are similarities, but eventually the rulings differ because there are dissimilarities that are important than the similarities. Anyway, then let me tell you that this sort of effort is an ongoing effort. It had not stopped then. In fact, Majma' al-Fiqh al-Islami, which is the International Islamic Fiqh Academy. And I understand that all of us have reservations and suspicions regarding anything that is government-related, that is, you know, related to Muslim governments. But at the end of the day, we have to be sort of reasonable, and we have to understand the complexities of life. And so not everything they're doing is bad, of course. So Majma' al-Fiqh al-Islami, which is the International Islamic Fiqh Academy, was started by the OIC, which is an Organization of Islamic Cooperation. That's the new name for it. When it first came out, its name was what? Arab League is different. This is Islamic. Organization of Islamic Conference. And then they changed it to Organization of Islamic Cooperation. I like the new name better. because it comes out of the Quran. تَعَاوَنُوا عَلَى الْبِرِّ وَالتَّقْوَى. So ta'awun, cooperation, it's a Quranic concept. So anyway, the Organization of Islamic Conference, which has about 59 members, so we've got plenty of Muslim nations. it has about 59 members. They established a fiqh academy or a fiqh assembly by the name of International Islamic Fiqh Academy. This is a very, you know, significant and important body of fuqaha. Yes, they are sent from their representatives or respective countries, and many times they may have agendas. The countries that are sending them may have agendas. But at the end of the day, when they discuss matters of fiqh, they just have to, you know, it has to be fiqh. And certainly, we it's not like we have bad thoughts about them. We should maintain good thoughts of all Muslims until proven otherwise, of course. So, but they do considerable work, and the declarations of the Islamic International Islamic Academy should be taken in consideration in any discussion. And one of their greatest projects is collecting al-qawa'id al-fiqhiyya. And this is a momentous achievement. I think they started this in 1988. So, and it, you know, it's only a few years ago that they completed the project. So they collected al-qawa'id al-fiqhiyya in 42 volumes. But they added to them al-qawa'id al-usuliyya or al-maqasidiyya also. Remember, we talked about maqasid al-sharia, objects of sharia, and how there are principles for maqasid al-sharia. And we talked about usul al-fiqh, and there are qawa'id that are usuliyya. And they added to them dawabit as well, which are the regulators, the fiqh regulators. So, but they combined them, and they put them together in one, basically, what is it? This encyclopedia of 42 volumes. It's called the Ma'lamat Zayd. Zayd is Zayd ibn Sultan al-Nahyan. It's the emir of the Emirates, or the governor of the former governor of the Emirates, who basically spent on the project or funded the project. So this is an ongoing effort, and it will continue to grow, because we will continue to have, you know, formulations, new formulations, adjustments, and there will be newly emerged scenarios that will require some qawa'id for them. But certainly, you know, the five major maxims will not change. Most of the major ones are not going to change. We're talking about adjustments, adaptations, refinement. That's the effort that's ongoing. But there is no revamping of or replacement of al-qawa'id by new qawa'id. So that is the qawa'id in the general sense. What about in the Hanbali sense? Because we're going over the Hanbali applications, qawa'id with Hanbali applications. What about the qawa'id in the Hanbali sense? And why are Hanbalis a little bit behind when it comes to qawa'id? Because as you know, Hanbalism is heavily textual. And Imam Ahmad, rahimahullah, he responded to 60,000 questions. It's poetry, so may not be exactly 60,000, but anyway. But he responded to tens of thousands of questions by haddathana. So his response to any question would be so-and-so related to us, which means textual evidence. He would come up with a report from the Prophet ﷺ directly, or from one of the Sahaba, or one of the Tabi'een, and he would not give his own opinion. He would answer by a hadith, and that's it. Heavily textual madhab. This does not mean that there was no qawaid. And when we began this series, we talked about how Imam Ahmad basically assertively said to his son, if not reprimanded his son, he said to his son, قلت لك الأبوال كلها نجسة إلا بول ما يؤكل لحمه. I have said to you before, all urine is impure except for the urine of those animals whose meat can be eaten or is permissible to eat. As if he's telling him, this is a qaida, keep it in mind, it will spare you the need to memorize 10,000 masail, because how many animals are out there? So if you keep on asking me every day, what about the urine of this? What about the urine of that? So it will not end. Anyway, so it doesn't mean that there is no qawaid in the Hanbali madhab, but certainly a madhab that is heavily textual would not see as, you know, early of progress in the science of qawaid than the other madhab that I have, you know, talked about. So Ibn Badran rahimahullah, Abdul Qadir Ibn Badran rahimahullah, who was a contemporary scholar to a great extent, he died about 100 years ago, or maybe exactly 100 years ago, Syrian scholar. His Ibn Badran gave us like a sort of a short summary of al-Qawaid al-Fiqhiyya in the Hanbali madhab. So the first thing he mentioned is Ibn Qadi al-Jabal. Ibn Qadi al-Jabal. Ibn Qadi al-Jabal. So al-Maktab al-Umumiyya in Damascus, so the public library of Damascus, Ibn Badran used to go to al-Maktab al-Umumiyya and search for anything Hanbali in Maktab al-Umumiyya or the public library in Damascus, which was full of treasures, manuscripts and treasures. So he was, and all of these were manuscripts. So he's telling us about the manuscripts that he basically was able to find in the public library in Damascus about 100 years ago. Some of these are in print now. Ibn Qadi al-Jabal's book has been printed. Okay, so Ibn Qadi al-Jabal, when did Ibn Qadi al-Jabal, so Ibn Qadi al-Jabal was one of the students of Imam Taymiyyah rahimahullah, Taqiyyuddin Abu al-Abbas ibn Taymiyyah. And that's why, of course, you know that Imam Taymiyyah is Hanbali, you know, 100% Hanbali, but he was very inclined to qawaid type approach to things. And he himself, as we will say, came up with many of the many qawaid for the Hanbali madhab. So it was not, you know, a coincidence that there was flourishing of al-qawaid from his time onwards, from the time of Imam Taymiyyah, who's considered the Imam of the Mutakhirin, or the latter generations of the Hanbali madhab. It's not a coincidence that there was flourishing of the qawaid. In fact, qawaid ibn Rajab, which are the most famous qawaid, qawaid ibn Rajab, Ibn Rajab died in 795. Ibn Qadi al-Jabal died in the 700s. So let me, did I mention this somewhere here? When Ibn Qadi al-Jabal died? 771. You know, Ibn Taymiyyah died 728. So he was one of the younger students of Imam Taymiyyah. Died 771, Ibn Qadi al-Jabal. So the most famous book on Qawa'id would be Qawa'id ibn Rajab. Qawa'id ibn Rajab, that's the most famous book on Qawa'id in Madhab al-Hanbali. And Ibn Rajab is the student of Ibn al-Qayyim, and Ibn al-Qayyim is the student of Ibn Taymiyyah. So you see the connection. In fact, some people said that Ibn Rajab did not write his book on Qawa'id, had found scattered Qawa'id written by Imam Ibn Taymiyyah, so Imam Ibn Rajab took them, put them together, and basically published the book. Of course, that's not correct. It's not true. Ibn Rajab was a much greater scholar than doing this, than stealing someone else's work. And he would have been proud to say, I found these qawa'id by Imam Taymiyyah. This is the teacher of his teacher. And basically serve them, you know, write a commentary or something. He wouldn't steal someone else's effort. So Ibn Rajab's qawa'id, you will find in Ibn Badran's, short history of Hanbali qawa'id, indicates his complete knowledge of the madhab, his great, you know, erudite understanding and verifying basically a knowledge of the madhab. There is also Ibn al-Laham. So Ibn al-Laham died in 803. He wrote a book on qawa'id, but it is a mix between qawa'id usuliyya and qawa'id fiqhiyya, and mainly qawa'id usuliyya, mainly qawa'id that belong to usul al-fiqh. Ibn al-Laham died in 803, mainly qawa'id usuliyya, but the book included qawa'id fiqhiyya as well. He also mentioned the Tufi. He mentioned the Tufi, and the unfortunate thing is the Tufi has qawa'id al-sughra and qawa'id al-kubra. Al-kubra and al-sughra, al-kubra and sughra, the major and the minor qawa'id, Tufi. And the Tufi died around 710 after Hijrah. He considered himself to be a student of Imam Ibn Taymiyyah. He certainly died way before him, but he was very impressed and influenced by him. Very impressed and influenced by him. Sulaiman al-Tufi, Sulaiman ibn al-Qawi al-Tufi, wrote, you know, two powerful books that, you know, we just hear about, but unfortunately, they are missing. Don't know where they are. We don't even have manuscripts for them. So until someone finds them, we won't know anything about Qawa'id al-Tufi. This is what Ibn Badran al-Allama Ibn Badran rahimahullah said about the development of Qawa'id and Madhab al-Hanbali. He did not mention an important development, which you remember we talked about al-Samurri Ibn Sunayna, Sunayna, al-Samurri. This great imam who died in 606. He was a contemporary of al-Imam ibn Qudama, and perhaps the last of the great Iraqi imams of the madhab, of the Hanbali madhab. So he wrote a book on al-Furuq, and we would basically consider this book to be the first thing in the madhab in that direction, because there is although al-Furuq are the distinctions, and they are different from the maxims, and we've gone over this, but it's the same direction. Basically, it is basically to bring together similar and dissimilar cases and to show why they deserve to have the same ruling or not deserve to have the same ruling based on similarities and dissimilarities. So he wrote a book called Al-Furuq, and this may be the first thing. So that was Al-Imam ibn Sunayna, Al-Imam ibn Taymiyyah rahimahullah, who died in 728. He had basically qawa'id scattered throughout his books, but there is a particular one called Al-Qawa'id, was given the name of Al-Qawa'id An-Nuraniyya. Qawa'id An-Nuraniyya. An-Nuraniyya comes from Nur, from light. And it is a wonderful, delightful book, but it is not technically on qawaid per se, although, as I say in the notes that I have sent to you, does include many qawaid. It does include many qawaid. One of them is قاعدة التراضي, العبرة في العقود بتراضي العاقدين. So the consideration in contracts is given to mutual consent. Mutual consent. This was a big thing for him, that mutual consent makes the default permissibility. Default in contracts for him is permissibility. And that's why he was one of the most lenient scholars when it comes to conditions, when it comes to contracts, and what may be halal and what may not be halal. You know, in the Shafi'i fiqh in particular, the form is very important. So they restrict the halal contracts to the ones that are traceable, that we know are halal from the time of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, who have sanctioned forms. But his theory was completely different, that the default for contracts is permissibility. And unless we have a reason to say it's impermissible, such as the presence of riba, the presence of undue risk-taking, the presence of inequity, then we must deem it allowable. And all the clauses people add in the contracts must also be deemed allowable. So al-ibra for him is mutual consent. How many clauses can you have in one contract? You know, no ceiling, unlimited number of clauses. We know in the Shafi'i madhab, for instance, and in the Hanafi madhab, you can only have one clause. In the Hanbali madhab, in the Shafi'i madhab and in the Hanafi madhab, the clauses are limited to those that have been traceable and sanctioned, you know. So they have a great deal of limitation of the clauses. In the Hanbali madhab, they don't accept more than one clause. So one clause in the madhab is permissible once you get to two clauses, two conditions in a contract. But it's not all kinds of conditions. There are conditions that are part of the contract, part of the essence of the contract, conditions that are needed for the contract, such as, you know, al-damin and al-rahn, you know, the mortgage and collateral and stuff like this. They would not put a ceiling on this. But the conditions, other conditions, extraneous to what is required by essence or what is needed for the benefit of the contract itself, they have a ceiling. But for him, it doesn't matter how many conditions you have, because the hadith that prohibits, you know, one condition was not considered, you know, that Naha Rasulullah an bay'in wa shart, the Prophet forbade a sale with a condition. This hadith in Imam Ahmad considered it to be weak. But the Hanbalis in general, they accepted the prohibition of two conditions. And we will come to it, and we will basically look at his justification for his interpretation of this particular hadith. So al-ibra is mutual consent. This is a qa'ida fiqhiyya, and there are other qa'id fiqhiyya. I mentioned here among the qawaid that he basically enumerated in that book. Contracts are concluded by whatever indicates their purpose, be it word or action. Contracts are included by whatever indicates their purpose, be in word or action. العقود تنعقد بكل ما دل على مقصودها من قول أو فعل. So if I, for instance, بيع المعاطاة, which is not permissible in the Shafi'i madhab, if I have, you know, my merchandise here, let's say whatever it is, apples, and you take one basket and it has the price, and you give me the you know, whatever, $10, if the basket says $10, you give me $10, I take the basket and walk away. I'm the seller. You take the basket and walk away. after giving me the $10. That's it. This is an acceptable transaction. This is a halal transaction. It doesn't have to have basically ijab and qabool. There doesn't have to be a proposal and acceptance for this to be a valid transaction, because this very act itself indicated our mutual consent. Then, you know, of the contemporary Hanbalis, As-Sa'di and Ibn Uthaymeen wrote significant works on Qawa'id, and also Nazm on Al-Qawa'id, poetic compositions on Al-Qawa'id, which are beneficial. But this is basically, in a nutshell, the emergence and development of Al-Qawa'id, still an ongoing effort on the refinement, adjustment, adaptation, but most of the work has been done. So, who's the first one to come up with Qawa'id? Abu Tahir al-Dabbas, okay? So didn't we say that Imam al-Shafi'i said, إِذَا ضَقَ الْأَمْرِ التَّسَعَ? Okay. Didn't we say Imam Ahmad say, قلت لك الأبوال, or, you know, whatever, لا يترك حق لباطل, etc. Aren't these Qawa'id? Why are we saying Abu Tahir al-Dabbas is the first one now? Didn't we say Umar radiallahu anhu said مقاطع الحقوق عند الشروط, which means what? That rights are contingent on conditions, or to the conditions. So why are we saying Abu Tahir al-Dabbas? Because he came with certain formulations that he considered to be qawa'id, and he put them together, and it was like 17 different. So he thought of a discipline. He thought of a discipline of knowledge. When Imam Shafi'i said إِذَا ضَقَ الْأَمْرِ التَّسَعَ, he was just stating a qaida, but he was not authoring or coming up with a new discipline of knowledge. He just included this in one of his books. When Imam Ahmad said لا يترك حق لباطل, he was not basically writing a book on qawa'id or claiming to have started a new discipline. So that's the difference here. Okay, now let's talk about the benefits of al-qawa'id. Now we need to discuss the benefits, the merits, the authority, and the benefits of al-qawa'id. Think about it. Think about the benefits of al-qawa'id. There is, I want you to read the notes. Please read the notes, because I'm not going to be able, because we're just going to have to move a little bit faster. I'm going to be able to talk about everything in the notes, so I want you to read the notes. But let's think of some of the benefits of qawa'id. Merits means fadl. You know, it's a virtuous science, of course. When we go over the benefits, you would recognize the merits of the science. What are the benefits of al-qawa'id? Benefits? Anybody? We'll give you a grasp over the detailed rulings, like you could have. Basically, it will bring together and hold together scattered rulings. Think of قلت لك الأبواب, الأبوال كلها ناجسة. Instead of learning, you know, the ruling of the of donkeys, the urine of bee. قلت لك الأبواب كلها ناجسة. بقول ما يأكل لحمه. I said to you, all the urine is impure except for the urine of animals whose meat. Whose flesh can be eaten, or whose meat can be eaten. So that is that's an important one, and that's for the faqih a very important one. But bringing together scattered rulings, so that it will organize your mind, and give you a grasp of the rulings. Now, what's another one? Didn't we say before that al-qawa'id usually state entity al-mudrak al-ma'akhaz, which is what? The legal basis. Legal basis. So when you say al-yaqeen la yazul bil-shak, when you say al-yaqeen la yazul bil-shak, and someone comes and tells you that I'm not sure if I broke my wudu or not, and you say to them al-yaqeen la yazul bil-shak, you know, certainty is not overruled by doubt, are you just simply telling him, are you simply bringing together scattered rulings, or you're pointing to the reason why he shouldn't worry about it and he should go ahead and pray if he's not sure that he broke his wudu? Because the original yaqeen or certainty that he had wudu is not overruled by the new doubt that he didn't have wudu. So here, al-qawa'id are not simply holding together scattered rulings for the faqih. They are actually pointing to the ma'akhaz, the mudrak of the ruling or the legal basis. So it points to the legal basis. What else would be an important benefit, particularly nowadays? Because it will give you an idea of the ma'akhidh al-shara in generality, the bases for the shara. Therefore, if you have a newly emerged matter, you could use the qawaid. Because newly emerged matters, you may not find specific evidence for every newly emerged matter, but if you have a good grasp of the qawaid, the principles, the maxims, you will be able to find rulings to address newly emerged matters. Find rulings to address newly emerged matters. This is also another great benefit. What would be another great benefit? You would understand, for comparative fiqh students, they would understand the differences between the madhahib, not at the surface level, not at the level of the branches or the level of the detailed rulings of the furu', the principles that caused the disagreements. So they will be able to have a better understanding of the differences, and they will be able to have they will be better acquainted with the other madhahib, because it's very hard for someone who studied one madhahib well to study all the four madhahib well in great detail. You know, some of the scholars certainly have done this, but for the vast majority of people, it is a very hard task to achieve. Therefore, at least if they are not capable of understanding everything about the detailed rulings in the other madhahib, they have this general understanding of the principles of the other madhahib. And that's also another great benefit. All of these are benefits for learning al-qawaid al-fiqhiyya. But for the vast majority of people, for the public, the qawaid al-fiqhiyya would give us, and I know that you're frustrated because we've been taking too long covering the introductions, and we haven't gotten yet to al-qawaid al-fiqhiyya, but you'll be able to realize that al-qawaid al-fiqhiyya will change your concepts, will reconfigure your mind, change your concepts, discipline your thinking, govern your practice. And that's not just in your religious commitment or religious practices, but that is in your life in general. That is in your life in general, as we will come to see. So these are some of the benefits, and so that's why this is a great science. Now, the issue that is very contentious now, a very, very contentious issue, is the authority of al-qawaid al-fiqhiyya, because nobody disagrees over any of the above. All of the above is agreed upon. قواعد الفقهية, learning قواعد الفقهية is of great importance. It regulates the mind of the faqih. It regulates the mind of the Muslim. And it gives you a grasp of the principles of Sharia, and which gets you closer to the spirit of Sharia and the objectives of Sharia, the essence of Sharia. You're coming closer, because the higher you go in action, you're coming closer now to the essence of Sharia itself. But they disagree over the authority or the proof value, or the authority of al-qawa'id al-faqhiyya. And I'm not going to go, in the notes in that much detail, but let me tell you why some people thought that al-qawa'id al-faqhiyya should not be used as evidence. Some people thought al-qawa'id al-faqhiyya may not be used as evidence for two reasons. One of them is, haven't we just said that al-qawa'id al-faqhiyya are derived by inductive survey of fiqh? So are they the root of fiqh or the branches? They are the branches. How could you use the branch to establish the root? That's one concept. They are the branches of fiqh. You can't use the branches basically to establish the root. What would be your answer to this? Isn't this true for many sciences? For many sciences, that the principles are deduced by inductive survey, and then we go back and apply those principles? What about nahw, grammar, Arabic grammar? How did we figure out Arabic grammar? Is it in the Quran? Fa'al marfu'an? No, inductive survey. This inductive survey gave us principles to go by? Yes. Do we take those principles and apply them back, to judge the furu'? Yeah. So it's not uncommon in sciences in general. But another argument is that these are aghlabi, not kulli, predominant, not universal. Predominant and not universal. Didn't we discuss this when we were talking about the definition and so on? They are aghlabi, not kulli. Not kulli, they're aghlabi, not kulli. Did we say they are aghlabi? No, we said that we don't agree with this. We said they are kulli, they are universal. They are aghlabi in some sense. Why did we say they are kulli? Because we said if there is no competition between the maxim and another piece of evidence, another maxim, text of revelation, necessity, this or that, if there is no competition, the maxim cannot قد اتردت. It would have continued to be consistent. You could have continued to consistently apply it. The maxim is consistent. The maxim, there are exceptions, and sometimes there are many exceptions, but the exceptions do not mean that the maxim is not consistent or universal. The exceptions are because of another maxim, another piece of evidence that basically warranted the exception. So the qa'idah in and of itself, without competition, would be consistent. But because of competition, and when we say this, isn't that true even for the Quran and Sunnah? True or not? Don't you find one hadith and find another hadith that you have to reconcile with it? So if you go by the first hadith that you found, you may be completely wrong because you have not taken in consideration the other hadith. Some ayat are general and they are specified by other ayat or a hadith and vice versa and so on. Okay, so that it's not only about the Quran, it's about any evidence. There always will be competition, and there always will be, not always, but there will be in competition and need for reconciliation. need for reconciliation. All of this discussion, all of this discussion does not pertain to al-qawa'id al-fiqhiyya that are themselves texts of revelation. Didn't we say la darar wa la darar is a hadith? It's a qa'ida and a hadith. Is that, can this be used as evidence? Of course, no one would argue about this. It's a hadith. The Prophet said it. So we're not talking here about the qawa'id that are themselves texts of revelation. We're talking about the qawa'id that are derived from the inductive survey of the entire body of fiqh. So should we use qawa'id as hujjah? Yes, we should use the qawa'id as hujjah until we have a counter-argument that is stronger. Until we have a counter-argument stronger. And when we have a counter-argument that is stronger, we will say, as Imam Ibn al-Qayyim said, لَعَمْرُ اللَّهِ لَهَدْمُ أَلْفِ قَاعِدَةٍ لَمْ يُؤَصِّلْهَا اللَّهُ وَرَسُولُهُ أَفْرَضُ عَلَيْنَا مِنْ رَدِّ حَدِيثٍ وَاحِدٍ, which would translate to, by Allah, dismantling 1,000 maxims not established by Allah and His Messenger is more binding on us than rejecting one single hadith. We will say this. We will say this when? When the qa'ida is conflicting with the hadith. Of course, you throw away the qa'ida. It's not established by Allah and His Messenger. You have a hadith that's established from the Messenger. You throw away the qa'ida. But until you have such conflict, you use a qa'ida. Now, certainly, you're not using any of this stuff until you have exhausted. We're talking about the mujtahideen, you know. We're talking about a mujtahid that is already aware of the Quran and Sunnah, already has extensive knowledge, comprehensive knowledge of the Quran and Sunnah, and he has one particular scenario where he can find a specific evidence for that particular scenario, and he's using the qaida. Of course, if you have specific evidence from the Quran and Sunnah to use in any scenario, use it. Who needs a qaida if he has an ayah? Who needs a qaida if he has an ayah? Nobody. Okay. Now, I just wanted to tell you that our imams in the Hanbali madhab seem to be on board with using the qawa'id as hujjah. I'll read verbatim what Imam al-Mardawi said in this regard. He said, among the evidences of jurisprudence, certainty is not overruled by doubt, harm is to be removed and not removed by harm, and harm permits the forbidden, hardship begets facility, averting harm is of greater priority than securing benefits, averting the greater harm with the lesser harm, custom governs, and considering the non-existent as existent for caution. Is he talking about qawa'id fiqhiyya here or not? Yes, of course. All of these are qawa'id fiqhiyya. He says these are maxims that resemble evidences but are not evidences themselves. But their content is established by evidence, and they are used to judge particular cases as if they are evidence for that particular case. What is he trying to say? He's trying to say that these are intermediate evidences. You know, the qa'idah is backed by an ayah. The qa'idah then was used to judge a scenario that the ayah will not specifically address. The qa'idah is derived not from an ayah, but from the inductive survey I'll give you an example that Imam Taqiyuddin or Sheikh Taqiyuddin rahimahullah Ibn Taymiyyah used. They asked him, should we use the right hand or the left for siwak? And when you learn things like this, it doesn't have to be that the ruling itself or what the scholar said must be true. It doesn't have to, but you're basically examining their approach, their way of thinking. They said to him, should we use the right or the left for siwak? He said, it has been stated explicitly by Imam Ahmad that you use the left for siwak. And it is the principle of Sharia that in orders in which the right and the left state, you dedicate the right to that which is honorable and you dedicate the left to that which is not. For him, siwak is what? Cleaning, not honorable. Siwak is cleaning. You're cleaning your teeth. It's just like you clean other areas in your body. So you're cleaning your teeth. So for him, it makes perfect sense. He's saying that Imam Ahmad explicitly stated that the left is used for siwak, not the right. But he's proving Imam Ahmad's point by citing the qaida. The qaida in Sharia is that any matter in which the right and the left participate, dedicate the right to that which is virtuous. By the way, this is a good thing to interrupt the cycle of infection. So if you eat with your right and clean with your left, the germ load on your right hand will be usually lower, even though your right touches your left often. But still, the germ load will be different between your right and left hands. Anyway, but that's a different issue. So all of that, what is the ruling of learning? Al-Qawa'id al-Fiqhiyya. And by this, we would have come to the end of introductions. Next time, we will talk about al-umur bi-maqasidha. Al-umuru bi-maqasidiha. Al-a'malu bin-niyyat. Okay, what is the ruling of learning Al-Qawa'id al-Fiqhiyya? Mustahab, wajib, fard ayn, fard kifaya, haram. Fard kifaya? Fard kifaya, everybody? Yes. Okay. You guys are not reading the notes. But it is fard kifaya, the default, but it becomes fard ayn on the mujtahid. Fard kifaya is the default. But the mufti, the mujtahid, must learn them, you know, because he needs them or she needs them. Okay? That will bring us to the end of this. Now we're done with all of the introductions. Next time, inshallah, we'll start the second section in the book, which is Al-Qawa'id Al-Kubra. That's the major legal, universal legal maxims. And we will start with the first one, الأمور بمقصدها. أقول قولي هذا واستغفر الله لي لكم. أنك محمد شلال الآن استغفرك وأتوب إليك. And we will come back at 9:25 inshallah. 9.